Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning. We're doing good here as far as lecture is concerned. So today is March 19th, and it's Wednesday, which, if I remember correctly, you had a lecture exam last time on Monday. Yeah. All right, so you know that's all been graded. You're seeing your Scantrons in lab. I think there's only one more lab group. No, two more lab groups. A Monday morning lab needs to see their Scantrons, too. All right, so they're in lab, but you can also see them tomorrow because they have office hours tomorrow. If you want to come in and take a look, you're welcome to do that. All right, so Bio 231, March 19th. Do we have any announcements from SI? Just going back to regular schedule starting today. Okay, sounds great. Yeah, now is the time to start getting ready for that third lecture exam. You're almost halfway done with the class now. As soon as you get that, oh, nice. I'm glad you found that. You're almost halfway done with the class after that practicum next week. And I guess that's what I wanted to show you. First, here's that schedule. So what did we say today? The 19th? Indeed. Fundamentals of nervous system. We're going to start getting into nervous system today. And usually the nervous system is the most challenging part of the class for students for some reason. And that's because I think you're used to looking at bones. You've been looking at arms your whole life and noses and ears and stuff like that. But you've probably never played around with anybody's brain. So it's going to look really different to you. And nerves and stuff like that. So we're going to get started with that today. And of course there's no practicums this week. Practicums are next week. For you guys, for the Wednesday group, Wednesday labs, it will be on the 26th. And who knows what's going to be on that lab practicum number two. Labs 4, 5, and 6. I agree. I like that, 4, 5, and 6. Anything 4, 5, and 6, except I'm not going to do shoulder. All right, so knee, yes. Face muscles, yes. Appendicular skeleton, yes. And as far as the remains of the axial skeleton, not the skull, but the vertebral column and rib cage. Yes. Okay. Got any questions with that? Make sure you talk to me. All right. That is next time. And don't forget, where's the answer key to the lab practicum? Lab manual. You have that in your possession, right? So just become familiar with that lab manual. All right. Before I get to nervous, any questions on the schedule? We're pretty straight with that. Okay. Put that away. As I was walking down to class, I noticed somebody had what appeared to be a really nice anatomy program. And I can't remember what machine they were using it on, if it was a Macintosh or a PC tablet. And I asked, and he said it was Essential Anatomy. And I go, well, it was really nice, because he was turning bones around, nice continuous fashion, getting a nice 3D view of a bone, plus being able to rotate it. And so I just did a Google on Essential Anatomy. And it looks like it's an Apple, runs on Apple products. I don't know if it runs on PC, and I really don't know how good it is, but it really kind of amazed me. So what I'd like to do is just take a peek right now at this YouTube video and see if I'm still amazed with it. Okay? Let's just take a look at this. Has anybody ever used Essential Anatomy in here? Yeah? Do you like it?
The basics.
Sorry.
To zoom in, reverse pinch, or open.
No pinching in here.
Bone,
yeah. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah,
okay. Okay. All right. So if it's really good, that might be worth it. I don't know if I can recommend it yet, but let's just take a look and see what this looks like. But they don't give you the pieces, right? You said? No features of the bones. Well, that needs to be improved quite a bit. But you're through that already. We'll have to look and see what the organs are like, because you're getting into that next. But at least you get a sense of the three-dimensional, right? So that's really helpful. You also sort of get that in PAL, because you get different views of a bone in PAL, your CD. Mandible. I'll take a look at that. Maybe we'll play around with that in lab or something. So another reason why I wanted to just pull it up is because I wanted to bookmark it before I forgot what it's called. Okay. Oh, wow. Look, mandible's gone. You see all those teeth down there. Ooh, how weird is that? Okay. I'm not sure I know how to stop it. Pull the plug.
Okay, well, thanks for your comments on essential anatomy. I'll turn my microphone back up because I think I speak so softly that I need a mic. Okay, how's that? Ooh. Okay, good enough.
Okay, so starting nervous system. I want you to become familiar with this very first page in your study guide or your lecture notes. It breaks the nervous system down into its important components. And whenever we talk about nervous system, I would like for you to look at this diagram that I have for you in 1B, number, well, 1B, the basic structural divisions of the nervous system. So I'm going to go over this, and then for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be learning stuff that fits into the scheme. And your book has a picture that's kind of similar, right? And here is the picture in your book, and here is my picture. Does one look more simple than the other? Okay, I like my picture a lot better, okay? You might like this one, but study mine and then translate it or transcribe it over to the picture that you have in your book, and that will be okay. All right, some of this you already know, like nervous system divisions. There are two main divisions of the nervous system. And you know these to be, what do you know so far about nervous system? Central nervous system, right? And then anything that doesn't fit into the central nervous system then becomes part of the peripheral nervous system. All right, so those are the two main divisions. It says it's working. Okay. I don't hear it necessarily. All right, so we got central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And the central nervous system, probably you know too, from the very first chapter, can be broken down into two divisions. And the two divisions of the central nervous system are brain and spinal cord. And since you studied bones, you know where these things are located. They're behind some armor plating. What kind of armor plating protects the brain? The cranium, cranial bones in the skull, right? And what bones are armor plating for the spinal cord? Yeah, all the vertebrae are. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, peripheral nervous system gets a little bit more complicated because it has two divisions as well. And these two divisions are determined by which way signals move from the periphery. Right, so a sensory division is when there's information going from the periphery into your central nervous system. So vision would be a good example of a sensory division because light is hitting your eyes and then your eyes send signals into your brain so you can appreciate what that light is all about. So that's sensory. Another name for sensory is afferent. Afferent division and sensory are exactly the same thing. People can use those terms in the exact same sentence, and so they're just synonyms of each other. But what direction do signals go? Toward the central nervous system or away from the central nervous system? If it is afferent, it is into the central nervous system, right? So sensory organ to the central nervous system. And in that example that I just gave you, what was a sensory organ? Yeah, we talked about the eyes, right? But any kind of sensory organ, like tactile sensation, olfactory sensation, is information in the periphery that goes into your central nervous system, and that's what we call an afferent pathway. All right? So things go in, but things go out as well, from the central nervous system out to the periphery, and we call that a motor division. Another name for motor is efferent, leaving the central nervous system. So, for instance, you know that skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. You have voluntary control of what your skeleton does. And so there's a signal in my brain that's going to tell my biceps to contract. What kind of what kind of pathway is that signal going to take from your brain to your skeletal muscle here? Is it an afferent or efferent pathway? Efferent or motor. Yeah, I told you already. Too bad. Okay. But it doesn't necessarily have to be to a skeletal muscle. It could be to any effector organ in your body, like your heart or smooth muscle or glands. All right. So, and just like we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two divisions, this motor division we're going to break down into two divisions as well. And I just gave you an example of one of them, and that is the voluntary division. This is efferent, so it's going from CNS out to an effector organ, in particular skeletal muscle, right? Because it's voluntary. We call that the somatic motor division, right? Because it's leaving the central nervous system motor. Somatic because what do you know about somatic? What does that sort of mean? I think we talked about that a little bit. Oh, no, we talked about it more in physiology. Somatic means body, right? Like a neuron, I think way back when, chapter one, you learned that a neuron has a soma, which is the body of a neuron. We're going to review that again today, but soma just means body, and your body means, in terms of you, not just in terms of neurons, will be anything that's not inside a body cavity, outside body cavity. So your skeleton and muscles, right, is not in a body cavity. So we call that a somatic area. Somatic area, so skeletal muscle. So, what happened? I just lost my monitor. You still have it. Nice. Okay. All right, so somatic, two voluntary organs. The opposite of that is going to be autonomic. Autonomic is a motor pathway that goes to some organs that you don't control automatically with your conscious, or you don't control voluntarily with your conscious thought. It is taken care of for you by your autonomic nervous system. It's automatically controlled. All right, so motor broken down into voluntary and involuntary, or we could say somatic and visceral. Somatic and visceral kind of pair up really nice. When you think of visceral, would you want to think of skeletal muscle around that move your skeleton? Where do you find viscera? Inside body cavities, right? So when you're thinking of somatic versus visceral, somatic is not in a body cavity. Visceral will be inside a body cavity, and there's very few things that we can control that's deep inside of a body cavity, like thoracic cavity, abdominal cavity, pelvic cavity, right? So that's what we call autonomic. And furthermore, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two divisions, and this is real important, right? I want you to use this theme to view a lot in terms of even the musculoskeletal system, endocrine system, as well as nervous system. Most important point in the class, and that is the two divisions are sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. So sympathetic and parasympathetic both belong to what division?
Autonomic.
That's right. That means involuntary, two visceral organs. All right, so what are some of these visceral organs? Visceral organ would be smooth muscle. You don't use smooth muscle to move skeleton around. You use smooth muscle to move things through your digestive tract or reproductive tract or respiratory tract. Okay. Cardiac muscle, of course, is not a skeletal muscle. That's in a body cavity as well. That's your heart. And then the third will be glands. Autonomic nervous system controls glands in your body. Like when you get too hot, you start to sweat. When you think of food or see food, start to salivate. That's autonomic nervous system. If you see food and you start salivating, can you stop that process from happening? Can you stop salivating? If you see like your favorite food ready to be eaten and you start salivating, you go, oh, wow, I'm really hungry. I see exactly what I want to eat. You start to salivate. Can you stop that? The answer is no, because it's under autonomic control. I don't even think if you practice you could do that. Maybe with some meditation techniques you could think of a desert or something. I don't know. But you'd have to really practice. So these things right here, 1, 2, and 3, these are what we call effector organs. They produce a response in your body. So jot down in your notes, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands. These are the three types of effector organs. Right. And these effector organs comprises everything that is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, right? Effector organs, these are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system. Okay. Now, let's go back up one step to somatic or the voluntary. What's the effector organ for the somatic nervous system? When a somatic nerve goes to this organ, it's going to produce a response. And what is that organ that's always going to produce a response in the somatic nervous system? That skeletal muscle, right? So we got a couple different divisions. I don't have that on the slide. Probably could put it here. The effector organs for autonomic nervous system are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, things you can't voluntarily control. Effector organ for the somatic nervous system, there's only one, and that is skeletal muscle. All right, so what does an effector organ always produce, whether it is for the somatic nervous system or for the autonomic nervous system? An effector organ produces what? I'm glad I'm asking. It always produces a response. Okay? So I think maybe we've looked at a reflex arc, a response loop, but we're going to certainly study them some more. And let's take a look at a response loop right now and incorporate some of these nerves that we looked at. All right, so here we have an object. And is this object, this beaker right here, is this in a dark room or a lit up room? Yeah, there's light available, right? So light bounces off of this thing and then into your eye. Okay, so what do we want to call your eye in a very general sense? Do we want to call it an effector organ? Effector? Effector produces response. Okay. What I would like to call this thing is a receptor. It's receiving information from your environment somehow, right? Like you have temperature receptors on your skin. That's receiving information from your environment. Your ears receive sound information from the environment. Those are receptors. So you can only appreciate, right, the stimulus, which is a visual stimulus, if you have a proper receptor, which in us is an eye. Right? If we don't have eyes, then we can't perceive that stimulus. So we have a receptor. And what is a receptor? What does it respond to? It responds to a stimulus. So probably in your notes, you should put, maybe you could even draw an arrow right here and put stimulus. A response loop always starts with a stimulus. And in order for you to appreciate that stimulus, you need a receptor. And that information enters, goes into the central nervous system for your appreciation. And what kind of pathway is used to bring that information into your central nervous system? Yeah, afferent or sensory neuron. All right, so that goes into the central nervous system. And you should probably know that, well, we're going to talk about shapes of cells in just a little bit. All right, so afferent neuron. And then you can appreciate that information, goes to different places, and if it's visual information, eventually ends up here in the occipital lobe. For instance, when we get to the central nervous system chapter, we'll look at that. Right? And so these neurons that are completely within the central nervous system, designated by this shaded square, and that looks like, I could guess, like a rose color? Green. The green rose right here. Anything in this area means central nervous system. Okay. Anything in this light blue represents peripheral nervous system, but afferent. And anything down, now this looks green to me here. What is this? Purple. This one here? Pink. And this is purple. Okay, never mind. I'm always so confused. I always think there's more than one colorblind person here when I talk colors. Okay. So anyway, this shaded area represents central nervous system. This shaded area down here represents? Okay. This one down here, your arm? That part of central nervous system. This is peripheral. So this is peripheral nervous system, and in particular, an efferent pathway, which is motor. All right. So you got a stimulus. You have a receptor. You have an afferent pathway into the central nervous system, right? And then the central nervous system figures out what to do with that stimulus. Maybe it needs to do something. Maybe this is not just maybe you're thirsty, right? And you see this glass of water right here. Central nervous system says, since you're thirsty, go ahead and drink it, right? Because you're thirsty. Or probably you would want water. Probably nobody wants an adult beverage after St. Patrick's Day today. Okay, so the brain says, okay, glass of water. And how do you drink that glass of water? Central nervous system has to send a signal out to the periphery, right? And so that's an efferent pathway to this skeletal muscle. Okay, that skeletal muscle is what we call an effector organ. And an effector organ does what? How would we label this arrow right here? That is a response, right? So convert this dotted line up here to a stimulus, right? And label it stimulus. And here I see a nice arrow, label that response. So just to keep this diagram really nice, put a little arrow right here. All right, so an input pathway is afferent, an outflow pathway is efferent. Okay. And I'm mispronouncing those words just a little bit, so that if I'm talking really fast or slur my words, you can see the difference between afferent and efferent. You really should say afferent and efferent, which kind of sounds similar, all right, in proper speaking. All right, so what do we have right here? Label this slide in your notes. This is a response loop. And what does a response loop always start with? A stimulus. And what does it always end with? A response. Yeah, that's important for you to know. Okay, so a response loop always starts with a stimulus, goes around, and it always ends with a response. Yeah. And another good question is, what produces a response? It is this thing right here. What do we want to call this thing? Okay. Yeah, there's a lot off that's missing from this diagram. Okay, so I want you to fill it in. This skeletal muscle right here is what we call an effector organ. Effector organ always produces a response. All right, so put effector organ. And you know this to be, what, a visceral effector organ or somatic? Somatic, because it's under voluntary control. It's not deep within a body cavity, right? So it's not visceral. And since you know that, now you know that's under voluntary control as well. The somatic division is under voluntary control. All right, in order for you to appreciate a stimulus, what do you need? And we should label the slide as well. What do you need? You can't say I, because if I put an ice cube on your shoulder, your eye won't be able to tell you if it's hot or cold. Right? So let's not say I right here. I want a more general name for this thing. It's a receptor. Yeah. All right, so I didn't take it in a nice logical order, so let's make sure that we fill this in. All right, so you start with a stimulus, yeah, stimulus. Put a little arrow here, stimulus. You appreciate that stimulus with, or you're sensitive to that stimulus because you have a receptor. That information then gets sent into the central nervous system with what kind of pathway? Sensory. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. All right, then the central nervous system makes up its mind what to do. We call that integration. It gets information not just from your eyes, but from your ears and from your surface of your skin, adds that all together to come up with a decision on what to do, and it sends that decision out through a motor pathway, all right, or efferent pathway to an effector organ. And an effector organ is always going to produce a response. So what do we got? Stimulus, receptor, afferent pathway, integration center, efferent pathway, effector organ, response. So there's a lot on here. All right. But that's really nice if you can break that nervous system down into those parts. And we call this the integration center in the central nervous system because you receive information from a lot more than just your eyes at one time. And your brain uses all of that information to make a decision on what to do. Right? Okay. So maybe an example of that. I see some flashing lights over here. Let's just say that we couldn't see anything, right? We didn't have any eyes. And we couldn't smell anything. We don't have any olfactory sense. And we can't feel temperature on our skin. We don't have that sense, right? So we have a lot of deficits in terms of sensation, but we can hear just fine, right? And so we're sitting here, and you're listening to my lecture, and all of a sudden the fire alarm goes off. What's going to be your response? Yeah, get up and, yeah, make your way out of the room, because that sensory organ is telling you that there's a fire. You can't feel it, you can't see it, can't smell it, right? All right. And, okay, so now let's say we have ears, we have sensory receptors, temperature receptors, we got our nose working, And we hear that fire alarm once again. But we don't see any fire, don't smell any smoke. It's nice and cool in here. And maybe let's just say this is the fourth time the fire alarm went off in the last 10 minutes. Now what is your response going to be? Probably not so concerned that there's a fire, right? So when you integrate, you get information from a lot of different sensors, and then that integration center in the brain makes a decision on what to do. It adds all of that stuff up. That's what we mean by integration. All right. So that is the second part. I mean, the first part of the lecture notes right here, divisions of the nervous system, right? You got sensory or afferent integration. Another name for integration right here is an association neuron. So this neuron is neither afferent nor efferent. Where is this neuron located? Completely within where? Central nervous system. So neurons that are completely within the central nervous system are what we call association neurons or interneurons, because they're between an afferent and efferent neuron. And we find them completely within the central nervous system. While the afferent neuron, partly in the peripheral, partly in the central nervous system. The efferent neuron, partly in the central nervous system, partly in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, nice simple diagram, but really important. Okay, so refer to this branching diagram for all of these things that we're going to be looking at in class. All right, so information processing, sensory afferent input travels from a point of somatic reception. Ooh, what does that mean, somatic reception? Somatic reception? On the surface of your body? Someplace that's not deep inside of a cavity, right? The somatic sensation. What about visceral sensation? Visceral sensation will be you're sensing something deep inside a body cavity, like dorsal body cavity, brain and spinal cord. Don't have a lot of sensors going on there. Okay, pelvic cavity, abdominal cavity. We're not very good at appreciating those senses because usually we don't get much information. There's usually not much going wrong with information from deep body cavities. But if something does go wrong, it produces a sense of pain that sometimes it's really hard for our body to analyze and understand what it is. And sometimes you might feel a pain in a different part of your body than from where it's originating from, if it's a visceral sensation. We call that referred pain, for instance. So referred pain is involved with this visceral reception. Just don't, like if you have appendicitis or something like that, you can't really pinpoint where that pain is coming from. Integration of the information inside the central nervous system. You add information up, and then the brain makes a decision on what to do. It sends that decision out through an efferent pathway to one of two places, to a somatic effector or to a visceral effector. What's an example of a somatic effector? Skeletal muscle. What's an example of a visceral effector? Heart. What's another example? Heart? Stomach? Yes, but I'm thinking more basic than stomach. Okay, cardiac muscle, let's not think of heart, let's say cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, which is in your digestive stomach, smooth muscles in your stomach, and as well as, and glands, because there are glands in your stomach too that secrete things into your stomach, right? And you can't control that with your thinking, unless you try really, really hard with a lot of practice. Yes, go.
So they just respond to either way, one is somatic or visceral.
Yeah, if there's an efferent pathway, it's going to an effector, and you either have a somatic effector or a visceral effector. One kind of somatic effector, three kinds of visceral effectors. Or you could even say autonomic effectors. All right, so let's look at a neuron, because this is the structural and functional unit of how our nervous system works. So where do we have a nice neuron? Oh, here is a great example of a neuron, right here. Okay. So this gold thing is a neuron, and you can see that it has a bunch of branches coming off. All right, we call these processes, just like when we see a bump on a bone, that's a process. These processes are highly branched but relatively short compared to other kinds of processes. These things are what we call dendrites. Dendrites are connected to the cell body. What's another name for body?
soma, yeah? So sometimes we call this the soma of this particular neuron. And then on the other end, there's another process, but it's not so branched, and it's very, very long. This is what we call an axon. So the three main regions of this neuron right here are dendrites, cell body, and axon. And I do see an arrow on this illustration. That means that this neuron sends information in one direction. Can you see which direction information always flows? And it never flows backwards, because the arrow only has one point on it, right? It doesn't have two points. So which way does information go? From dendrite to? Let's think of those three areas that we just learned about. It goes from dendrite to cell body to axon. Perfect, right? So that is the direction that information flows, and it doesn't flow backwards. All right, some other things about this neuron. Well, you see some things that you're familiar with, like the nucleus, nucleolus, right? Some organelles like mitochondria. Neurons need a lot of ATP, and that's the job of mitochondria, remember. And then there's all kinds of endoplasmic reticulum inside the cell body, just like everything you would expect. Centrioles, for instance. Okay. So, if we look at dendrites and cell body, we would like to characterize this area as the receiving part of a neuron. This receives signals from other neurons. Or maybe if this is in the periphery, maybe this is the kind of neuron that can perceive light, right? So this is the receiving end of a neuron. And then those signals get, what does this kind of look like? It's called axon hillock. You have one of these things in your kitchen. You might even have one of these things in your trunk of your car, maybe your garage. What does this look like? A funnel. That's right. And you should actually think of this thing as a funnel, because it's going to funnel information from all these dendrites in the cell body into the axon, right? So that information flows into an axon. And now the axon we call the sending part of a neuron. So dendrite and cell body are the receiving part. The axon is the sending part. And I think you need to take a physiology class to really see why that is so. But it would be really good that you understand that right now. So if these dendrites are the receiving part, when I grew up, I could look at a TV set or a radio and have a nice analogy in my mind what I'm looking at here. You guys have a deficit. You don't know what these things are in terms of electronics. Maybe you do. Well, what is this? What are these dendrites remind you of if they're the receiving end of a neuron? Like antennas. Yeah, like antennas, right? Which is the receiving part of a TV or a radio. So think of these things as antennas receiving signals, okay? And then this axon is going to be the opposite. It's the sending part. Okay, so what do we got? Dendrite, cell body, axon hillock. And then a nerve impulse will travel down this axon to the axon terminals. And there are some special things that are going to happen that we're going to look at. That signal then is shared with other neurons in this neighborhood. Not electrically, but through something we call a synapse. We'll look at what a synapse is all about in just a little bit. But I need to say just a little bit more. I don't see just one cell here. I see one neuron, which is really big and has a super long axon, and it's in this gold color. Yeah? Okay. And along the axon, I see like a string of pearls, kind of like in a, maybe a gray, bluish-gray color right here. Okay. These are part of cells of the nervous system, but they are not neurons. These support what a neuron does. We call these support cells, or sometimes neuroglia cells, or neuroglial cells. And in particular, this is what we call a Schwann cell. And a Schwann cell wraps itself around an axon, and then there's a little space, and that's an important space, and then there's another one, and there's another one, and another one. And these are actually pretty large cells. 2 millimeters is coming to mind. That's really big. You can see 2 millimeters with your naked eye, right? The diameter is still microscopic, so you might not be able to see them, but they're very long. And these things line or surround themselves along the whole length of an axon. So you got a Schwann cell, and then a node of Ranvier. This gap between the Schwann cells is a node of Ranvier. See that? Oh, yeah, right here, node of Ranvier. After a node of Ranvier, you got another Schwann cell. Node of Ranvier, another Schwann cell. And then on and on down the line. I'm going to talk about Neurolemma probably in just a little
bit later. Yeah, I'll talk about that neural lemma just a little bit later. All right, so the beauty of having these Schwann cells is because they wrap themselves around an axon. They produce a chemical that you have to know about, and it's called myelin. Myelin is a lipid, right? And myelin is like insulation on a wire that you have at home. Okay? Let's just say you have a toaster you have plugged into the wall, and it doesn't have any plastic or rubber around the wires. And you want to unplug your toaster. Would you grab the wires with your bare hand? No, because the electricity would flow right out of the wires into your body and could stop your heart or give you electric shock. Usually that's really uncomfortable. Okay, but if there's insulation around the wires, electricity can't get out. Same thing for the Schwann cells. They wrap insulation around the axon, so the electrical activity can't get out of the axon when this happens. So the electrical signal bounces from one node of Ranvier to the next. It just skips right down the axon, and when that happens, the nerve impulse travels very fast. So that is why we have myelin or myelinated axons, is because then it can send signals very fast. I think you have to know what that's called. It's called saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction is very, very fast. If an axon is not myelinated, then that nerve impulse has to go molecule by molecule by molecule by molecule, and it's about 100 times slower. So think of that. I think it's an insurance commercial. What's better, fast or slow? And you're going to say, well, fast is better, right? And I don't have anything cute to say after that. But indeed, that's true, right? Fast axons are much better than slow axons. Maybe there's a bus coming at you. What would you like? Fast or slow axon? Fast axons, right? So these are really modern kinds of pathways because they have these myelinated little beads around them. Okay, then the signal comes down to the axon terminus, and we'll see what's happening in this axon terminus in just a little bit. Somewhere on this slide, you might want to put down what kind of neuron this is. We're going to learn three kinds of neurons. This one right here is what we call a multipolar neuron. Multipolar, because there are dendrites on one side, axon on the other. It's got like a number of different poles. And you have seen some pathways, right? You saw an afferent pathway. You saw an association neuron in the central nervous system and an efferent pathway. These multipolar neurons make up association neurons and motor neurons, but not sensory. Multipolar for association or interneuron and motor neurons. Okay, so if this is a motor neuron, which way is this signal going? And remember, it can only go one way. Where is it going? Where's it starting? Where's it starting? If it's a motor neuron, it's starting. Okay, that's a piece, but I want to know like the major part of your nervous system, major part of your body. Yeah, it starts right here, dendrite, and then out toward the axon terminus. But where in your body is that? Central nervous system to peripheral nervous system, if it's motor, right? So this is taking signals away from your brain to your effector organs in your body, like skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, depending on what nervous system it is, whether it's autonomic or somatic. Okay, so that's a neuron. What do we have here? Cell body, axons, dendrites. Characteristics of neurons, ability to conduct electrical impulses. This is true. Okay, the support cells don't conduct electrical impulses. Only neurons do. Here's an example of a neuron. Schwann cell is an example of a support cell. Support cells don't send electrical signals. Neurons do live an extremely long period of time. So it's not exactly true that the neurons that you have in your brain right now were exactly the ones you had last year or will have next year, but that's mostly true. Sometimes it's difficult to regenerate neurons in our central nervous system, and other times it is not. There are other kinds of support cells that determine whether your brain is going to grow and whether it's going to grow. And that's important because your brain does change a lot. The structure of your brain changes a lot, especially if you're learning new things. That's one theory of long-term learning. So when you take a class like anatomy, physiology, the structure of your brain is changing quite a bit. And actually that's necessary to happen before you really learn something. So Can that happen overnight?
No.
You cannot learn anatomy overnight. Can't learn physiology overnight. Maybe microbiology you can learn overnight, but not anatomy and physiology. Okay? Because the shape of your brain has to change. So that is really scary, isn't it? Because you turned the shape of your brain over to me to change it. I'm remodeling your brain as you're listening to me. All right, so that's really important. They don't divide, but they have a high metabolic rate as signified by these mitochondria. And what's the job of mitochondria once again? Make ATP. How important is ATP, especially in terms of these neurons in your brain? Okay, because they can only make ATP when they have oxygen. How long can this neuron actually conduct electrical impulses if we cut off oxygen and mitochondria cannot make ATP? I think we've talked about that. Say your heart stops beating, blood isn't getting to the brain, how much consciousness do you have left? Do you have enough to run over to an oxygen bottle?
3 seconds,
okay? Because this neuron is what? It has a high metabolic rate to conduct all of those electrical impulses. And then, after what period of time does this neuron actually die?
3 minutes,
not a very long period of time, because then ATP is so depleted, it can never come back to life. All right, so I think we have talked about that already. All right, so that's nervous tissue. And I also pointed out some support cells right here. So, neurons receive information via dendrites and the soma. Right, stimulus goes from the dendrite to cell body and then down the sending part of a neuron, which we call an axon. Okay, classifications of neurons. One that now we're familiar with is what kind?
Multipolar.
So this is for a motor neuron or an association neuron, which we call an interneuron. Here are a couple other kinds, bipolar and unipolar. Let me see where we have a picture of these things. They got put in a little bit different location in your book. Okay, so I think I have them in a table right here. And maybe I can zoom in. I'll zoom in just a little bit. So what does this one look like here? The first one on the left. Multipolar, right? Dendrite, cell body, long axon. Information only goes in one direction. What can you tell me about this axon, which is really novel and very nice? It has Schwann cells, so it's myelinated, so it's fast. Okay, let's move over to the next one of three that we're going to look at. All right, can you see that this one here looks different than a multipolar neuron? Here's a cell body. I see the nucleus, some cytoplasm in there, and then there's a very long projection on one side, another really long projection on the other. And this is kind of hard to tell which one is an axon, which one is a dendrite. But we know that these branches right here have receptors. So if these have receptors, this is the receiving end or the dendrite, right? And then the signal comes into the cell body and then it goes down to the axon to the axon terminus. This one right here is what we call a bipolar because it just has these two poles. We don't have many of these in our body compared to other kinds, but these are important for special senses in our body, like vision and olfaction. What does olfaction mean? I'm not sure you guys know. Smell, yeah, olfaction, vision, hearing have bipolar neurons, but that's about the only place. And maybe for some equilibrium senses. The third kind, right, so this is neither motor nor, it's more involved with sensory, but I really wouldn't call it a sensory neuron. All right, so multipolar is motor. This bipolar is sort of sensory. It's involved with sensory processing. But now here is your neuron for sensation. This is a sensory neuron. And remember that sensory or afferent is part in the central nervous system, part in the peripheral nervous system. I see one cell body, nice nucleus, cytoplasm. There's a single process coming out, and then it bifurcates. You know what bifurcate means? Just splits, yeah, it just splits, right? Into two really long processes. This is what we call the central process. Here we call the peripheral process. And why do we call this the central, or why do we call this the peripheral? Where do we find this neuron? It's partly in the peripheral nervous system, partly in the central nervous system. The part that's in the central nervous system is called the central process. The part that's in the peripheral nervous system we call the peripheral process. Right? That's where we find these things. So signals go from these dendrites, these receiving endings, right, up through the peripheral process, past the cell body, and then it enters the central nervous system with this central process right here. So this sort of is more like an axon, right? But this is sort of like an axon too, so it doesn't fit a nice classical description, right? So that's why we like to say peripheral process and central process. Peripheral is still receiving information. The central is really sending information into the central nervous system. This one we call a pseudo-unipolar because it has one projection, but it bifurcates right away, so it's not really a true unipolar neuron, so we call pseudo-unipolar neuron. What does your book call it? It runs around with another name sometimes, too. They're not even named? Ah, unipolar, or pseudo-unipolar. Yeah, can go by either name. I like pseudo-unipolar. Oh, look what we have here. I just noticed that. I see one color. I see a second color and third color. Does that match up to that other slide that we were looking at? The afferent neuron, central nervous system, peripheral. Okay, nice. Good for you guys. There was a question? Oh, yeah, you got to develop a good eye for these. They're really a lot different. Look, here's a cell body with a lot of dendrites coming right off the cell body.
No, the bio and the nucleus, they look the same.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this one and this one?
Yeah.
Ah, but let's look. Here's a cell body. Two major processes coming off the cell body at two different locations. Over here, for the pseudo-unipolar, how many processes are coming off the cell body?
One.
Only one. Here was? Here, how many are here?
Two.
Yeah. The difference between one and two, I don't know, that's pretty big for me.
Yeah.
The bipolar doesn't have Schwann cells. Yeah, they're usually so short, it doesn't really matter. So these are not drawn to scale. They're not drawn to scale. Yeah. A Schwann cell is a type of neuroglia. It's a type of support cell. And we have we're going to look at seven kinds of support cells. And here, a Schwann cell is one kind of a neuroglial cell. Okay? So it's a subclassification of a neuroglia cell.
So the bipolar, they don't have a Schwann cell.
No Schwann cell. Yeah. Which means, what about the conduction? Relatively slow. But it's so short, it probably doesn't matter very much. It's more for signal processing. It's more for manipulating information in our body. Okay. All right, so these are exam figures. I could put this cell on the next lecture exam, and I could ask you, what's the shape of the cell? And you would say? Yeah, unipolar, maybe pseudo-unipolar would be a choice. And the function would be? It's a function. Sensory, right? Sensory. Information is going from peripheral nervous system into the central nervous system. What's the shape of this cell here?
Bipolar,
and the shape of this one is? Multipolar. What's the function of a multipolar neuron? Ah, I would not, if I were to guess, that would be one thing I would not guess for multipolar, not sensory. I would say motor or association, interneuron, yeah, interneuron. All right, so there's a lot of details I know you can't just remember when you listen to a lecture. You got to go back and study a little bit, but those are some important things that you should be looking at. All right, so those are the structural classification of neurons. You got three, and then you should know the functional classifications. That's the same thing that we did for joints, right? We looked at structural classifications and functional classifications and how they relate to each other. All right, so that's one kind of cell that we have, one kind of cell that makes up nervous tissue, neurons. Other kind of cell that makes up nervous tissue are what we call support cells or neuroglia cells. Neuroglia cells don't send electrical impulses, but they do other things, right, like remodel our brain and other kinds of things. Astrocytes is another kind of support cell. I'm going to look at that in just a second. Okay. The Schwann cells that we're looking at here, we find only in the peripheral nervous system. Schwann cell, only peripheral nervous system, not central nervous system. Okay, so peripheral nervous system has a Schwann cell. So let's look at the support cells. Well, I tell you what, number two, Two kinds of support cells in the peripheral nervous system. One is a Schwann cell. The other is a cell we call a satellite cell because it completely surrounds the cell body of this sensory neuron. I'll show you a picture of that in just a little bit. All right, so we're kind of done with peripheral nervous system. We see that has two kinds of neuroglia cells, but let's go to the central nervous system. And what do you see? How many support cells in the central nervous system? More than two, right? There are two. Astrocytes, microglia cells, ependymal cells, and oligodendrocytes. So let's take a look at the shape of some of these cells. Let's start with oligodendrocyte because it's the most similar to a Schwann cell. So now you kind of know what the function of an oligodendrocyte is. It has myelin. It creates insulation around an axon in a neuron where? In the CNS or PNS? In the central nervous system. All right, let me see if I can find a nice picture of one. Okay. Oligodendrocyte is central nervous system, and let me take a look right here. I guess this is the best picture that we have. Okay. All right, let's start back with this. Here we have what kind of cells? Schwann cells, peripheral nervous system. So I see one Schwann cell. I see another one. Here's a different one over here. So a Schwann cell wraps around itself, it wraps around an axon only in one location. These are all individual cells. So one of these areas of insulation are due to exactly one Schwann cell. Not so in the central nervous system. Here is a myelinating cell, but how many axons is this one wrapping around? Is it just one? I see one, two, three different axons. So an oligodendrocyte has more branches to it, and it can myelinate many axons, not just one. And as a matter of fact, not only in this location, but this oligodendrocyte could make myelination here, right, and then that node of Ranvier, and then another one here, and then another one here. So multiple locations on a single axon or even multiple axons. So it's a little bit more complicated compared to a Schwann cell. Okay, so oligodendrocyte. And you should know where that is, central nervous system. What's the function of oligodendrocyte? Produces myelin. Yeah, what's the function of that myelin? It's insulation. And because you have that insulation, what do you know? You know something about nerve conduction. It's fast. That's right. So these axons are transmitting information very fast as a result of that. So that's important. There's a pathology where this myelin gets attacked by a person's immune system. A person's immune system builds antibodies. The antibodies attack the myelin, destroys the myelin, and maybe even starts to put plaques down, some scarring tissue on top of these axons right here. So as the myelin disappears in some parts of a person's, where? Mm-hmm. Yeah, central nervous system, like brain, guess what happens to the speed of conduction then? It's really disturbed, right? So their brain can't really communicate. Different parts of the brain really can't communicate with each other because the timing is wrong. There's like a master clock in our brain where information has to arrive at the right time to make sense. Okay, and those plaques actually can impede a nerve impulse going through there. And I think you're all familiar with the name of that disease where this myelin is attacked in certain parts of a person's brain. And that's called multiple sclerosis. Right? Multiple sclerosis is when the myelin sheath is degenerating because it's being attacked by that person's immune system. We call that an autoimmune disease. Right? And some people are beginning to understand how to control that process. It used to be really debilitating, but now there are certain drugs that can reduce the length of active scar formation and make the periods of remission really long. So some people really know how to manage that disease within them pretty well. Okay, so it's a recurring thing where it can get bad and then better and bad and better, and the job then or the goal is to make the periods of time when you're feeling fine extended, right, to make them much longer than the periods of time when you're suffering from multiple sclerosis. All right, so that is this neuron here. That's one of four. What's another one we want to look at? All right. Here is one that's pretty cool. And what kind of cell do I see right here? Neuron, because it's that nice gold color. All right, the support cell that I'm looking at is what everybody calls is an astrocyte. Here's the cell body. They call it an astrocyte because look at the symmetrical arrangement of all these processes coming off the cell body, and it kind of looks like a star up in the sky with light rays coming out of it. And it used to be that people that could make microscopes were the exact same people that knew how to make telescopes. So people that looked at stars were actually the same people that looked at things underneath a microscope, and that just reminded somebody of looking at a star, this shape right here, so that's called an astrocyte. It has projections, right, and it wraps the terminal process of a projection around an axon, but it doesn't produce myelin. So the job is not for speeding the rate of electrical conduction. It is because of, here I have a tube. What is this tube here and this tube here? It looks red. It's a blood vessel, a special kind of blood vessel called a capillary. And the astrocyte I see is connected around this capillary, okay? And then the process goes to the cell body, and then it goes right into the neuron right here. All right, so the astrocyte kind of acts as a special door-to-door delivery system for important metabolites like glucose. All right, so that's really nice. So glucose just doesn't have to diffuse. It can actually be delivered to these neurons. So that's one really nice thing. The other thing is that we have a lot of toxins in our blood, especially right after St. Patrick's Day. And we don't want those toxins to enter our brain because we just can't live at all without a functioning brain, right? And we know that alcohol is what? It intoxicates you because it is a toxic compound. When an astrocyte wraps around a capillary, it forms a barrier between the brain and the blood, and we call that the blood-brain barrier. It keeps a lot of nasty toxic compounds out of our brain. We probably couldn't even function without it. Right, so that's another function of an astrocyte. It makes the blood-brain barrier, which usually is a good thing. Sometimes it's not such a good thing because let's just say somebody has a brain tumor and we have a nice chemical agent that we know that specifically attacks that tumor and kills it, but it doesn't kill the brain. You would like to use that chemotherapy to destroy that brain tumor. But a lot of those drugs cannot get through the blood-brain barrier. Okay, and so then pharmacists have to go back to work and figure out how to make that drug so that it kills the tumor, plus be able to get through the blood-brain barrier. That probably sometimes is as difficult or more difficult because we can't just inject drugs into the brain. Okay, blood-brain barrier. Usually it's a good thing. Door-to-door delivery system. This astrocyte also maintains the electrolytes like sodium and magnesium around this neuron right here so that the electrical properties of the neuron are proper. So it adjusts the environment for this neuron. Astrocyte also secretes factors that tell the neuron where to grow and whether or not it should grow. We call those neurotrophic factors. So this astrocyte is important in learning because these neurons have to grow in order for us to learn certain things. Right? It changes the shape of our brain. And also, if a neuron is damaged, it can maybe help rebuild that neuron in our central nervous system. All right, so this astrocyte is really important. And for instance, somebody that has clinical depression, it's really difficult for them to learn things. Okay, it's almost impossible to learn anything new. And one of the things that we realize is that it's probably due to these astrocytes not secreting trophic factors, right? And it just deadens the response of this neuron right here to where it can't grow and it can't respond to new kinds of stimuli, can't change its structure to new kinds of stimuli, and then a person just can't learn new things very easily. It's really, really difficult for somebody with clinical depression. And so we would certainly like to know how to control these astrocytes, right, so that people can learn things faster. That would be really nice. All right, so that's some of the functions of this astrocyte. Even though it looks like it's putting myelin down, it's not, right? It's making blood-brain barrier. Another kind of cell. Has a lot of processes coming off of it, and I see it has these processes going to different neurons right here. But this is what we call a microglial cell. This is very similar to a white blood cell that you have in your blood. And we didn't talk much about white blood cells, but maybe just a little bit. Can anybody remember what a function of a white blood cell is? Fights infection, fights disease. That's right. So that's the job of this thing. Okay? We don't have a lot of blood cells floating around inside our brain, which is a really good thing. We call that meningitis. That can be deadly very quickly. So here's the kind of immune cell, and it's a nervous system cell. It can actually crawl around, and it's looking for dead neurons, damaged neurons, bacteria, viruses that are inside the brain, maybe some fungi got in there, right? And it's also looking for tumor tissues. And when it finds a tumor, then it's going to kill that particular tumor. So I'm sure all of us have had many brain tumors, but we've never noticed it because why? These microglial cells in our brain destroyed it before it became clinically relevant. It didn't produce any kind of deficits in us. Right? Unfortunately, some people, their immune system, at least in this aspect, is diminished, and when they have a tumorous cell in their brain, it just kind of grows uncontrollably because this microglial cell just isn't educated enough to identify that particular tumor. Okay, so that's the job of this microglial cell. You got one more kind of cell. Support cell, and yeah, ependymal cell. It's got a little swing to it, kind of like epiphysis. Okay, so this is where peripheral nervous system or central nervous system?
Central.
It's central. We're still talking central nervous system, and it just so happens, you don't have a picture of this in your mind because we haven't looked at the brain in detail yet, but there are big cavities inside your brain filled with fluid. We call those ventricles. And they're very important to have these big spaces inside our brain. But we don't want those spaces, that fluid, to be in direct contact with the brain. Just like the blood-brain barrier, there should be a barrier between this fluid-filled cavity, which we call a ventricle, and the nervous tissue inside your brain. And here is that barrier. And it kind of looks like an epithelium, but they're really nervous system cells. And it has cilia on them. And so what do you think these cilia are doing? Yeah, they're moving that fluid around in our brain. There's actually like a circulatory system within those ventricles that we get to look at later on. So it moves this, and this fluid, I guess you should know what this is called. It's called cerebrospinal fluid. So if it's cerebrospinal fluid, where do you find this fluid? The definition is in the name. Cerebrospinal fluid. Spine? And? Yeah, cerebrum. Cerebral, brain, and spinal cord. So you find it in both places. All right, so the ependymal cells make that barrier, but it also, in certain locations, makes cerebrospinal fluid. Ependymal cells make cerebrospinal fluid, but also acts as a barrier between the spinal fluid and the brain. Those are probably the main functions of it. Okay. All right, let's look at how myelin is produced. I think we have a word slide of that. Okay, so let's just say this, it's defined, peripheral nervous system. So what kind of cell is this here? A nice Schwann cell, right? So it migrates over to this axon because axons are myelinated, not other parts of a neuron. And you can see it starts to surround the axon. And as it's, so it's a little bit of a shapeshifter cell. What can cause the shape of the cell to change? What kind of organelle is responsible for that? What's responsible for moving chromosomes around inside a cell during mitosis? Yeah, like microtubules, right? Microfilaments. So they push and pull on the cell membrane, get it to curl around this axon, and I can see a nucleus, and I can see cytoplasm right here. So it's a nice living cell. It's just kind of surrounding this axon. And then this edge right here tucks underneath this edge, and it wraps itself some more and some more and some more and some more. And so now I see a number of layers, right, surrounding the axon, but this nucleus is still in the same spot. Cytoplasm is still in the same spot. So these inner layers that have been wrapped around the axon, we call that the myelin sheath, because this part of the cell is filled with myelin and not cytoplasm. So we call this the myelin sheath. The cytoplasm we see only in the outermost layer, and it's kind of thin. Here it's a little bit thicker, but it gets kind of thin. The outermost layer, outermost wrapping layer, is what we call the neurolemma. All right, so you got a Schwann cell has two parts. When it wraps itself around an axon, the neurolemma, which is superficial, and the myelin sheath is deep. That's how you would think about that. All right, so that's how that forms. Here's a nice micrograph. Here's a nice micrograph that you see all the myelin sheets right here. Here's the cytoplasm or the neurilemma. And then in the very inside, you have the axon. Ooh, I bet you could tell me what these things are. I can almost tell. It's not quite the correct section. This is a transverse section. Usually you see it in a longitudinal section. But remember, neurons are highly metabolic, so these things are mitochondria even. Yeah, making ATP. Okay. All right, here's that sensory neuron. Schwann cells, peripheral nervous system. Here are the cells that surround the cell body of a pseudo-unipolar neuron. These are what we call satellite cells. All right, and so they just enhance the life of this sensory neuron by providing nutrients, regulating ion concentrations, things like that. Okay. Say that again? The satellite cells are called satellite cells because remember these guys had telescopes that looked up in the sky, and it's really, for instance, if you look at Jupiter, it's really easy to see the moons of Jupiter that are satellites of Jupiter. They're moving around all the time. And so when people looked at this underneath a microscope, they said, oh, well, these look like little moons surrounding this cell or satellite cells. But your question was?
They look like they cover.
They kind of cover. They surround the cell. Yeah. Yeah, they don't move around like moons around a planet, but could be close. Okay. I want to get to this thing sooner or later. Let me look at our word slide right here. Oh, we talked about saltatory conduction versus continuous conduction. I'm going to come back to synapse in just a little bit. You know what? No, I think I want to talk about a synapse right now. So not this particular slide. All right, so as I'm finding some slides on synapse, what's the structural and functional unit of life called?
Cell.
That's a cell. Nice, 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 nice. What's the structural and functional unit of, what have we looked at so far? So we looked at life. What about compact bone? Osteon. We really haven't looked at muscle yet. Have we looked at muscle? No. Yeah, we've looked at muscle. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction?
Sarcomere.
Yeah, sarcomere, right? So it's really nice to know what a structural and functional unit of something is. Well, a synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. All right, and just like the sarcomere, and just like an osteon, and just like a cell, we got to understand its structure to understand what the function is all about. All right, so I really want. Ah, here it is. Whew. Good, good, good. Okay, so let's look at this slide. On this slide, on the right, I see one neuron. Right here, are dendrites, and then here's that axon. Axon is myelinated, but I also see another neuron. Here I see the second neuron, but this is just the axon. I don't see the cell body. It's not important for this diagram. Here's the axon. So what's the function of an axon? Is it the receiving part or sending part?
Sending.
Yeah. So here's the sending part of the first neuron, and it's touching what? What part of the second neuron? The receiving part. Okay, so this axon of the first one is touching dendrites on the second one, and that's really nice because the axon is the sending part touching the receiving part of the second neuron. This junction between them is what we call a synapse, and it's a special kind of synapse that we're going to call a chemical synapse. First, we're going to call this a chemical synapse because when information comes down this axon, it comes down as an electrical signal. And then it hops from one cell to another cell, not as an electrical signal, but it's converted into a chemical signal. And then that chemical signal is received by a dendrite, and it's converted back into an electrical signal, which then goes down this axon over here. So how does information go? Electrical, then chemical, and then electrical again. So this is what we call a chemical synapse because a signaling molecule, a signaling chemical is used so that information can be sent from the first neuron into the second one. And so we need to look at what's happening in this little junction that we call a synapse. All right, so here's the axon terminus of that first neuron. Here's the dendrite of the second one, but we don't want to use that terminology. Since this is a synapse, the one that's sending information, we want to call that the presynaptic neuron or the presynaptic membrane. And that's going to send a signal to the postsynaptic membrane or postsynaptic cell. So here's the presynaptic cell, here's the postsynaptic cell. And again, information only goes in one direction. And it's from what? The pre to the post. Okay, and I'll ask you why that is in just a little bit. So here are some things about a synapse that you should be aware of. A synapse has a lot of mitochondria. Means it requires a lot of ATP. It has a lot of vesicles with that signaling compound, that signaling chemical that's inside these vesicles. And since this is a neuron, and this neuron is going to transmit information into the postsynaptic dendrite here, sometimes we call this a neurotransmitter, right? Because it's coming from a neuron and it's transmitting information to the postsynaptic cell. So here's a neurotransmitter. That's just a general name. We're going to learn some specific names of neurotransmitters as well. Maybe you've heard of some like norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, some of these things you've maybe heard of before. Okay, those are the examples of neurotransmitter. All right, so let's look at the scheme. A nerve impulse comes down an axon, and when that nerve impulse flows over this bouton terminale, or terminal button, or axon terminus, it's got a bunch of different names, but it's a little swelling at the tip of that axon. It causes these vesicles to move over to the presynaptic membrane, and when it does, it fuses to the membrane, and whatever inside that vesicle gets exocytosed, or you could say secreted, into the space between the neurons. Right. And that only happens when an electrical impulse comes down. Right? So there has to be an electrical impulse coming down. When that signaling molecule or neurotransmitter is released into the synapse, I see a high concentration by the presynaptic membrane, low by the postsynaptic, so that neurotransmitter is going to move. How is it going to move? Okay. By diffusion from high concentration to low concentration. So it's going to move across this cleft that we call the synaptic cleft, right, from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic membrane, and there it's going to cause a response, right, in that postsynaptic membrane. So in order for this postsynaptic membrane to be able to sense this neurotransmitter, what does it have to have? This is a nasty diagram because it's missing, but you should draw it in. What does this postsynaptic membrane have to have so that it can sense these signaling molecules? Right, what do you have to have in order to sense light? A receptor, that's right. So this postsynaptic membrane actually has to have a little protein here, which we call a receptor. The neurotransmitter binds to it, and when it binds to it, that causes another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. All right, so draw in that little receptor. That's really important. All right, so we got the axon terminus with synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. All right, we got the synaptic cleft, which separates these two cells. Then you got the postsynaptic cell that has receptors for it, right? And the signal can only go in one direction, from the presynaptic into the postsynaptic cell. And you should probably know why that is. Why does signal always only go in one direction, not the reverse direction? This direction, let's just call this the antegrade direction. It does not go in the retrograde or backwards direction. Why is that? Yeah, I want to know why. Okay, because what cells have a receptor? What cell can receive information? Dendrite. Yeah, dendrite, which is the postsynaptic cell. The presynaptic cell doesn't have a receptor. So the presynaptic cell is like what? Blind to the neurotransmitter, can't sense the neurotransmitter. What cell can? Only the postsynaptic cell because it has a receptor, right? So the postsynaptic cell can only receive information, and the second reason is, does the postsynaptic cell have neurotransmitter to send anywhere? No, only the presynaptic cell has transmitter, so the presynaptic cell is the one that sends information because it has neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic cell receives that information because it has receptors, right? So it's the shape of this synapse that determines which way information flows, right, across the synaptic cleft just in this direction. Electrical signals can't hop from the pre into the postsynaptic cell because you know what would have to happen if that were true? You'd have to have like a little lightning bolt, right between these cells. And we don't have lightning bolts between our cells in our body. So what kind of synapse is this, electrical or chemical? Chemical, because it has chemicals that go across the synapse to signal cells. And then there's another electrical signal that starts. As soon as the transmitter binds to the receptor, it starts another electrical signal. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical. Okay, sign-in sheet. I got the sign-in sheet here in case anybody needs it.